ones so bonded with their dragon they can harness its strength and fire, though the connection is more myth than reality. The beast glides toward the Colosseum that's clamped between both lengths of wall like a ghastly, blood-splattered crown. "Creators," I mutter, watching the molten maw circle lazily above the massive structure. The feeding bell gongs loud enough that I feel the sound in my marrow, and a haunting hush falls upon the crowd, the air igniting with the frantic thump of beating wings. A thunder of molten maws swarm from every direction, clotting the sky with a riot of ravenous motion, charging for the free meal, their sharp maws pointed toward the Colosseum like a volley of arrows. They converge, snapping at each other, talons slashing, vibrant feathers spraying as they battle for whoever's currently tied to the stake within the structure. An ear-splitting scream, followed by a blood-curdling howl of anguish, echoes into the otherwise silent ditch with eerie precision, almost like someone willed Claude to carry the sound down just to fuck with us, to remind us of the chilling consequences for those who madden the crown. My hands shake with my welling rage, fingers tangling through the folds of my gown, fisting the thick material. I'd be up there right now, screaming for blood in the spectator seats if the one being fed to the beasts were a monster like Tarik Relikan. But it won't be. They never are. They're others like me, caught masquerading as nulls. They're folk who speak out against the king, or parents of gifted children who try to keep their young from being forced through the painful screening process required of every offspring, from being shaved, pierced, ripped from their homes in exchange for the crown's prescription bucket of bloodstone, gratitude for their great contribution to the Fade's swelling militia. A paltry bandage for a wounded heart. The searing scream is snipped to the tune of splitting wood, and my guts plummet so fast I'm struck with the urge to vomit. A victorious molten maw shoves from the Colosseum, churns its feathered wings, and heaves into the sky. Blood leaks from its honed mouth as the beautiful, monstrous creature glides west, a sea of heads turning to watch it sail along the wall. All the oxygen wicks from my lungs. In that direction, the wall eventually dips, half swallowed by the molten maw's spawning grounds, Boggith. Whenever they fly west with fresh meat, there's only one place the victim is going to end up. Spat out in a nest, fed to the dragon's young. Live prey. I shiver from the base of my neck all the way to the tips of my toes, my gaze coasting across the silent crowd, most staring skyward through wide eyes, their mouths pinched shut as if under lock and key. Apparently, the Kingdom of the Fade used to be a creator's blessed place to live, where children's giggles echoed through the ditch, where the wispy watercolor sky inspired an era of music and arts. Then our current king was sworn in, caring only for his military might. I'd like to have seen Gore back then, when the kingdom was in its prime. Would like to have experienced the reality that was colorful to the core, not just on the outside. I think that's the living Fallon was referring to. Not this. This can't be it. I swallow the rage boiling up my throat, certain there's enough anger inside me to incinerate this city in a single blow of breath. Even so, I force myself to continue forward, ignoring the feral urge to stalk to the city hutch, hire a carter, and fly west to Drelgod, to where King Kadok currently resides, overseeing his militia. Only a fool would believe I could get close enough to kill him without a fierce amount of backup, the tri-beaded male constantly guarded by dual-beaded elementals and his vicious dragon, making my anger useless. At least until the Elding decides to stop clipping leaves off this malignant tree and start hacking at its roots. I take a zigzag path up the ditch's lofty interior, scaling 31 stories, scanning my surroundings as I cross a crumbling sky bridge and step onto the side of the wall that looks out upon the shade. I skulk down a rough-hewn wind tunnel that reminds me of a choking throat, the ground etched in bands of runes that trigger all sorts of terrible responses for anyone other than myself or Essie. The immediate urge to shit themselves. The sudden loss of vision, like they fell headfirst into the shade's inky sky. And my personal favorite, the unnerving belief that a molten maw just stuffed its beak down this very tunnel and is trying to pluck them out like a bug in a hole. I pause by what looks very much like a rubbish chute for the velvet trog and unlace my bodice, revealing a fadestone brown skin suit that's snug against my form and much easier to climb in. Bundling my veil, boots, bodice, and supply bag within the folds of my skirt, I post the package, watching it shoot diagonally down, then disappear from sight. Most prefer to make their homes on the other side of the wall, where sunlight shafts through colorful windows and fills rooms with warmth, where folk can line their sills with potted vegetables that thrive in its constant flow. Not me. I like the cold, and I can't keep a plant alive to save myself. Though none of that holds a candle to the reason why I chose the brisk, quiet side with the dusky vista. Wind toys with my hair as I stop at the end of the tunnel with my toes hanging over the edge, looking out upon the snow-covered plains that stretch toward the south. The clouds have almost entirely cleared, allowing me an uninhibited view of the bruised horizon pocked with moons cast amongst a bed of distant stars. Closer are the vibrant balls of fallen molten maws, as if someone took the colorful clouds of the fade, shredded them, then packed them into compact orbs and tossed them skyward. You can see the outline of their massive, majestic wings bound around them like feathered fans. The lanky plumes of their tails that sometimes fail to tuck in before the dying dragon solidifies, looking like flicks of paint. Much farther in the distance are rounds of pearl, iridescent, and gray spilling shards of moon plume light, radiant bruises smudged against the otherwise dark horizon. There's something poetic about looking up and seeing that which has passed. A soft launch into grief for those who linger below. If I could ball myself up like a moon plume and nestle amongst the stars when I know my time has come, I would. Not that I think many would seek me out, but I'd die knowing I left something bright behind in this beautiful world sketched in so many shades of ugly. I also like the idea of being able to fall from the sky and squash somebody if they piss me off. I'd aim myself at the Fade King and obliterate him in a heartbeat for doing such a shit job of keeping his kingdom together. Petty, but justified. I seek out the small silver moon of an adolescent moon plume that's drawn my eye since I first looked upon the tombstone-laden sky, pulling my lungs full of crisp air, a true, untarnished smile stretching across my face. Many called that particular moon Haze Perch. It's certainly not the largest, nor is it the brightest, nor the most magnificent to look upon. But for whatever reason, I can't imagine not being able to open my eyes each aurora rise, look out past the ever-vibrant clouds in this part of the world, and see that little wonky moon with the malformed wing. Essie once asked me if I wanted to know its story. I smiled and shook my head. Heartbreak has a tone that echoes through the ages, and her voice was laden with it. I don't want to look at my favorite moon and think of things that hurt. I want to look at that small moon plume and imagine it had a beautiful life, full of happy things that make your heart heavy with love. Perhaps that makes me a coward, but I have to pinch my smiles from somewhere. And that moon, it never fails to give me exactly that. A smile. Rave. Chapter 11. I drop from the wind tunnel's mouth, using the abundance of cracks and divots to latch myself to the side of the wall and scale downward, threatened by a fringe of rock shards that hug the base of the wall below. The hungry promise of a swift and brutal death that hasn't yet been able to chomp down on me. Or Essie. Thankfully. Gripping a jutting piece of stone, I transfer my other hand to the space beside it, then drop before what appears to be more flat wall. A perfect, ruined illusion. I swing through what's actually a large, ever-open window, into a snuggle of slightly warmer air, rich with the smell of something rich, buttery, freshly baked. I land in a crouch, my appetite returning with a salivating vengeance. Yum. Is that Butterman loaf? Essie says, slouched over a seeing scope at our small feasting table laden with tools, tinctures, and metal pots, scratching at whatever's beneath the scope with one of her etching sticks. I could smell the blood on your boots the moment they shot down the chute. Reaching the table, I pinch a finger of loaf from her plate and stuff it in my mouth, groaning through my first bit of sustenance since I set out last Aurora fall. The dense pillow of savory goodness drenched in melted butter, slathered in a sweet layer of Bogsberry preserve. I smile. I love Bogsberry preserve. Essie doesn't, meaning she left this piece specifically for me, knowing I'd be ravenous the moment I swung in the window. Not that she'd admit to it. Not that I'd want her to. She pretends not to worry about me. I pretend not to worry about her. We coexist in parallel with zero expectations, bar the odd supply list and the fancy things she makes for me, and it works blissfully. Perfectly. I wouldn't change a thing. Things got messy, I say through my mouthful, moving into our rough-hewn kitchenette. I lift a cloth on the freshly baked loaf and slice off a fat chunk, topping it with a scrape of butter and a dollop of preserve. Cranking open the icebox, I root around for a bulb of bright green fruit, slicing it into segments I pile on my plate. Want some goro? They're not ripe. I spin with the plate balanced in my hand. Sure they are. The butt end goes yellow when they're ripe. She peers up from her task, red brows almost bumping off her pretty, freckle-dusted face. That one will blow your tongue off. I stuff a pale shard in my mouth, and my face screws up as I choke on the zesty tang. They're not ripe, I sputter, spitting it into the trash bowl. Essie chuckles under her breath, then tucks her head back down, peering through her looking glass and getting back to whatever she's doing. I slide my fruit to the side and focus on the loaf while watching her work, my gaze shifting from the graceful, deft movements of her fingers to her delicate features. Tawny eyes, nose slightly upturned at the end. A null clip is cut from the tip of her left ear that's a little longer than mine and with more of a backward tilt, giving her this hypnotic, ethereal visage. Coils of hair hang well past her hips like a thick, ruddy cape that matches the metallic specks in her eyes, such a unique shade of red I've never seen before. The only splash of color that brightens her appearance. Ever. I take another deep bite of loaf, thinking back to the day she moved in. I told her she could do whatever she wanted to the previously sparse decor. Naturally, our shared living space is now the same color as her entire wardrobe. Black. The rough kitchen counters, the jagged ceiling, the fibrous rug that covers the uneven floor. Even our plump, heavily cushioned cedar by the window, big enough to fit three despite the fact that we never have visitors. By choice. My gaze lifts to the window specially ruined by Essie to ward off intruders, remembering the slumber I woke to her standing over me in the midst of one of her episodes, black smudged beneath her haunted stare as she waved a blade about, screaming at me to fill a cup with my blood. Now, that it was a matter of life or death. The end result? An entrance that all but murders intruders. Stroke of genius. This is delicious, Essie. Thank you, I say, taking another bite. Of course, Glad you like it. Understatement. She knows her Butterman loaf is my favorite. No idea what she puts in it, but damn, it's good. What are you working on?
A diamond cap for your tooth, she says, etching away. I've been trying to find an ore dense enough to withstand these fiddly runes. Freak accident, but I discovered diamond works. Oh!
Hand poised, she flashes me a wide-eyed glance that's so full of life it renders me breathless. No doubt high on whatever thought just threaded through her spectacular mind.
Did you get my lark?
Mm-hmm. I tuck my hair behind my ears and make for the oddly shaped stone basin that caught all the bits I pushed through the chute earlier. I got blood on it, but did my best. I set the plate aside to rummage through my belongings. What does the diamond crown do?
Emits an invisible, impenetrable barrier around your head and chest without cutting you in half.
Hand stilling, I look over my shoulder at her. Without cutting me in half? You mean my body? She nods so fast her hair's a sanguine churn.
Took me a bit to figure that out. Promise it's good now, though.
Right. Glad you're thorough, I say, gripping the bag.
Always. It's almost done. A few fine runes with that new etching stick and it'll be ready to activate. Figured it's a good time to attach it since Rex Zaros is hunting you.
See, you've been reading my messages again. She shrugs, adjusting the scope of her looking glass.
It flew through the window after you left, bumped against the sill until its nose was squished. I put it out of its misery by unfolding it.
And reading it.
My eyes slipped.
They have a habit of doing that. I shake my head, sliding the bag across the table for her to rummage through. Flip side of using so much blood in the active runes etched around the window, the parchment larks sometimes think the window is, well, us. Ergo, the source of Serene's eternal frustration whenever she can't get a hold of me. Essie pulls her head from the bag, her face a tad paler.
No Spanglepoo?
I blink at her. I'm sorry, what?
From Yuskorn, the Undercity librarian. He's got a pet Spangle. Is it in your pocket? Please tell me it's in your pocket.
There's no shit in my pocket, Essie. Why do you need Spanglepoo? She opens her mouth to speak, but I swiftly cut her off. Remember, my brain's not as big as yours. If you start talking about biophysics, I'll perish. She opens her mouth again, closes it, seems to think for a bit, then starts to talk.
The stone they eat is rich with a special ore that's otherwise hard to find because it forms in minuscule drops that never grow larger than a pinhead. It doesn't break down in their digestive tract, so it's the most effective way to gather it. It's a creamy color, and it melts at a much lower temperature than most other ores, making it the perfect adhesive for binding runed caps to your teeth.
You're joking. Her brows crush together.
For the first time in my life?
All the warmth drains from my face, my hand whipping out to steady myself against the table. That's what you used to bind the other activation cap to my tooth? She nods.
Spangle shit? I rinsed the actual feces off, then sterilized the ore, but yes, it had been shat.
Creators. I shove my tongue to the right side of my mouth, feeling around said cap. Let's file that under things Rave doesn't need to know, I mutter, making for the cabinet where I pull out a mug. Ever.
Noted.
I glance back to see her shuffling in her seat, scratching at the back of her head.
Given Rex's renowned accolades, I was hoping to get it attached.
There's no rush. With this new, rather revolting information, the least amount of rush ever.
What if he targets you?
I lift the jug of filtered water from our icebox, filling my mug. I've been instructed to lie low, and we both know Rex can't get to me here. The only way we'll clash is if I accidentally run into him on my way to pick up my handsaw and accidentally slit his throat, accidentally going against Serene's direct orders, and accidentally saving the life of one of my comrades. The only upside to being indispensable? I'm almost certain Serene won't fatally maim me for the transgression. Just rough me up until she feels like she's got control again. The usual shit. Essie's chair grinds against the floor as I gulp my belly full of water, draining the mug before I place it in the basin and grab a band off the counter, using it to pull my heavy hair back into a high updo. The silence grows prickly and needles me from behind. I turn. Essie's no longer facing her project. She's facing me, hands on her knees, eyes wide and brimming with worry. A look that impales me through the chest so hard I feel it poke out the other side. "Stop," I growl. "Don't look at me like that." Why is she looking at me like that? Her eyes gloss over with a sheen of sadness that's so much worse. "Reeve, I can't lose you."
"We don't do this, Essie. We work just fine the way we are. Don't break something that's not broken."
Her brows pinch together as she opens her mouth, but nothing comes out, like the words are too big to wrestle free.
"Good. They should stay in.
I don't want her to tell me she's worried, that she cares. I don't want to say those same words back to her. The folk I care about die."
"The point is moot, anyway."
I spin, rinsing my mug and plate in the basin, eyes firmly cast on the task.
"I can't go to the Undercity until I receive a lark signaling the all clear."
I dry both bits of crockery, put them away, then move to the trough and gather my things.
"I'm exhausted. I'll get these stupid feathers off my lashes, catch some rest, then collect your spangle shit once I receive a lark from Serim. Deal?"
She doesn't answer. When the stretch of silence grows too loud, I spin, looking into her big, tear-filled eyes. Shit.
"Deal, Essie?"
Lips pinched into a thin line, she nods, the slow beat of a reluctant agreement. I make for the trapdoor that leads to my suite and lift the hatch, stilling halfway down the steps when Essie's words impale me like a blade thrown between my ribs, wedging deep.
"I don't like Serim any more than you do, but for once, I think you should listen to her. Please, Rave, I need—"
She sighs, pausing before she throws another verbal dagger, this one knocking the breath right out of me.
"You're the only family I have."
I squeeze my lips so tight together, I'm surprised they don't fuse. Essie's broken. Actually, this entire cycle's broken. I need to close the cover on it and flip a new one. A normal one, where folks stop voicing their concerns for my well-being and calling me family. I don't get nice things like that without a price tag too heavy for me to pay.
"Please don't go to the Undercity without me. You know I hate it when you go down there alone."
I step out of her line of sight, swinging the trapdoor back into place with a heavy clunk. My suite is sparse compared to the rest of our living space, the only decoration aside from a single piece of wall art being the moons I've drawn upon my otherwise unpainted ceiling with bits of coal. Essie's never asked why. Though, by the way this day is going, it wouldn't surprise me if she charged down here and dumped the question at my feet like a steaming pile of spangle shit.
"Damn it," I mutter, lumping my stuff on the ground. I release a heavy sigh, casting my low-lidded stare on my twill pallet stretched across the ground by the large window that dominates my southern wall. No stuffy blankets or pillows. Just comfortable space to curl up and pass out. Something I want to do right now, but if I don't pick these feathers off, I'll wake up looking like a scraggly molten maw mid-molt, missing sprigs of my lashes. Been there, done that. "Don't be lazy, Rave. Deal with your shit."
I scoop my things off the floor again and move through to my dressing space tucked behind the back wall, hanging my gown, pulling my daggers free from all the hidden compartments like plucking a bird of its plumage. I shelve them all except the one I keep strapped to my thigh, checking my skin suit for blood. Finding none, I decide it's fine to sleep in and hone the dregs of my energy into scrubbing my boots, removing the damn feathers, and taking care of my business, battling through a yawn as I step back into my sleep suite. I pause before a flat piece of stone hanging on the wall,
carved to look like a nesting moon plume. Easing it aside, I reach into the hole behind, retrieve a small wooden box that I carry to my pallet, placing it beside the window. The pane of glass is stretched from floor to ceiling, offering a view of the fade's gradual smudge into the distant shade, framed by frosty runes that make the window look like stone from the other side. Another one of Essie's clever adaptations. Seeking that wonky moon in the distance, I see the rising aurora tangled around it like the frayed threads of a silver gown unraveled by the handsy wind. A soft smile fills my cheeks, despite this weight settling in my chest, like something sitting on me. Something that feels a bit like regret. My smile falls. Essie called me family, and I walked away. After everything she's been through, I walked away. What the fuck is wrong with me? How can I look at that moon with so much love in my heart? Love that ricochets off my ribs every time I look at Essie. Stupid question. I know exactly what's wrong with me. Loving that moon feels safe. Moonfalls are so rare, it'll likely always be there, accepting my quiet adoration. Loving Essie. It makes me feel like I'm handling something fragile that'll break apart in my hands if I tighten my grip even the slightest bit. Sighing. I lift the lid on my small box. Nee bats her plain parchment wings and rises from the hollow, fluttering around me in a churn of giddy motion, nuzzling my face, shoulder, neck. She tries to wiggle into my ear, making it impossible not to smile. Careful not to hurt yourself, I murmur, gently nudging her away from my face and easing her toward the rest of the room so she can stretch her little wings. She does a few lofty loops, then tucks her head and plummets. Too fast. Too far away. She collides with the floor beak first, and I flinch. Fuck. I scramble up and dash to her, swooping her into my palm. Nee, I really wish you'd stop doing this. She jerks, flipping onto her back, bearing the three beautifully scrawled letters visible on her abdomen. The rest of her message tucked within the darts of her streamlined body. N-E-E. I cut her an incredulous glare, unimpressed by the not-so-subtle nudge for me to unfold her. You know, of all the tricks you use to get me to read you, this is my least favorite, I mutter, waiting for her to move again. To dart back into the air and burn off all the energy she's built up while I've been out. Nothing. I'm serious. I jiggle my hand. You look dead. Stop it. Still, she doesn't move. I blow on her. Again. Again. My heart crimps. Nee. She waggles her parchment tail, and all the breath shoves from my lungs as prickly relief packs me full. I shake my head, rubbing my sternum. This is called rewarding bad behavior, I grouse, gently unfolding her crushed beak, head, tail, wings, then body, bearing her message that's more than five phases old. I need you. Three small words I'm certain were never meant for me. Not that it stopped me reading them again and again. I devour the delicate sweep of each tailored letter, brushing the pad of my thumb across them like a knee belly scratch as I recall the moment she came to me. She must have gotten lost on her journey to whoever she was intended for, instead nuzzling into the crook of my neck like she was seeking comfort from a storm. I'd opened her, read her message, and realized how important she was. Come from somebody who was not okay, though they perhaps didn't know how to say it aloud. I'd folded her up and blown her back to the sky, asking Claude to carry her high into the currents so she could recalibrate and head in the right direction, find the one she was intended for. The next rise, I'd woken to her resting in my palm, a tear in her wing and a very squished nose, like she'd battled against Claude's currents, and won. Hard to part with her after that. I sweep my thumb over those three words again, then gently fold her back up, flattening her beak crimp and checking that her rip hasn't gotten any bigger. She bursts from my hand in a flutter of motion and bats about the room like she's burning off a furnace full of energy. If you're not more careful, I'll pack the room with down feathers, I warn, and she flips through the air, swooping toward me in a wobbly glide, dipping into the crook of my neck where she nuzzles in. I settle my hand atop her and rock until she stops wiggling, my thoughts drifting back to Essie, to the jarring way she looked at me through those big eyes glazed with too much. Sighing, I make for my pallet, then cast my stare to the sky outside. Fallon once told me that as a youngling, she used to lie on her back and wish upon the moons, wishes that would sometimes come true. Magic, she called it. I've never believed in things that make no sense to me, aside from Essie's magnificence. But perhaps I should start wishing on the moon I love so much. Ask it to find a way to replace my heart with a soft and squishy one, so I never have to see Essie's eyes flood with sadness again. Creators, I'm an asshole. I curl up on my side, snuggling knee, looking at Hay's perch while humming the gentle tune that always clears my mind, no matter how loud the world seems. Diary entry. Eloin Nevon. Age, 9 phases. 5,030 phases after stone. Hadeon found me in his sleigh just before the aurora set. I thought he'd be happy to see me. Instead, he said he was going to take me straight home to Erythia in a big, growly voice I'd never heard him use before. But when the aurora rose, he boiled me tea, packed our things, and then we kept going in the same direction. I think he forgave me a little bit because he gave me a butterberry chew this slumber after we ate some felt-ringed fungus soup. Hadeon didn't finish his bowl or eat his chew, but he did spend time shaping a dragon scale blade. He told me we'll be there in 3 aurora cycles, that we'll spend 1 slumber in the hatching hut on the outskirts of Netherin before he leaves at aurora rise right when the mommy moon plumes go off to hunt. That I'm not to leave the hatching hut until he returns or 3 slumbers have passed without him. Seems a bit silly to me, since I didn't hide in his sleigh to sit in a hut and eat butterberry chews. I came to get my own moon plume egg.
Con. Chapter 13. Seated in the back of a gloomy booth, I keep my hood up despite the velvet curtains pulled shut so nobody can see in. My only companion is a heavy mug of mead I bring to my mouth, drawing a frothy glug of the thick, bitter-tasting liquid. Hissing through my teeth, I bang it back on the table, scowling. The mead in this city tastes like it's been distilled in a muddy barrel, but I prefer it over the murky water that's twice as dirty and leaves grit in your teeth. The quenching warmth takes only the sharpest edge off this feeling in my chest, like I've been rattled so hard my bones split and stabbed me through. I know it wasn't her, that it's impossible, that I'm going mad, and have been for phases. Still, those eyes, that scent, that voice. Growling, I lift the mug to my lips again. The curtain parts. A hooded female with a proud but delicate stature steps into the confines of my booth, chased by a parchment lark that nudges her shoulder, urging her to snatch it up. She does, sighing. Forging myself into a vision of false composure, I draw another muddy sip, swallowing as she settles in the seat opposite me, face hidden within the cowl of her cloak. Surprised to see my brother let you out of his sight again, I rumble, setting the mug back on the table. Princess. Kazari pushes back her hood, brows raised as she regards me through haunting azure eyes. Her white hair hangs well past her waist, bound in a braid almost thicker than my wrist. Her complexion so pale I can see the web of veins beneath the skin of her hands. My gaze lifts to the diadem clinging to her forehead, the black ether stone sitting central amongst the curls of silver metal she's been crowned with since the day she took her first breath. It's been a while since I saw her last, since Veya and I went to Mah's special place and found her there. Realized she'd been there for a while. Holed up. Hiding. Not the first time she'd run away. Obviously not the last. She reaches toward the sconce protruding from the wall like a gnarled claw and dangles the still-fluttering, unread parchment lark over the flame. Fire gobbles it up. Her fingers pinching the thing until it's almost gone before she drops it to the stone table and watches it turn to ash. I frown. I'm devoted to the creators now, she announces, brushing off her hands, reaching over the lark's corpse to steal my mug. I took the oath of chastity. You're my niece. The last thing I want to talk about is your chastity. I can do whatever I want now that Pa's no longer afraid of losing me. Lie, I growl. Low enough, my voice won't carry beyond the curtain to where a lone fiddle player is carving a tune in the common area beyond. Your moon plume isn't in the imperial hutch I purposely inspected before meeting you here. And we both know you wouldn't trust her with some loose-lipped city wrangler. She rolls her eyes, finally thieving a sip of my mead, face scrunching as her eyes narrow on the offending drink. You came via a carter, I declare, and she thumps the mug back on the table. You smuggled yourself out of Arethia after your unveiling ceremony while the skies were busy, figuring it would take your pa longer to notice.
How very astute of you. Your drink tastes like mud.
It's an acquired taste you'll have to get used to if you intend to spend the rest of your long existence as a fugitive, carving out a life for yourself in a broken kingdom that's no place for a sheltered princess with no wits about the world. She arches a brow.
Who shat in your stew?
Who taught you to speak like that? The smallest smile pulls at her lips.
Guess I'm not as sheltered as you think.
I grunt. Doubtful. Silence reigns long enough that she clears her throat, her gaze dropping to the drink still clutched in her hand.
I appreciate you agreeing to meet with me. You saved me from a very long trip across the Boltanic Plains.
She was on her way to Dom, then. I wasn't aware I had a choice, I say, crossing my arms, head tipped as I regard her in the firelight. Your lark was firmly worded. I'm not used to being ordered around. Not sure I'd take it from anyone else. Her cheeks redden, and she nips a guilty glance at me from beneath pale brows.
Sorry, my tutor taught me to lead with a firm hand. His methods were questionable, but I guess some of his teachings had merit.
Firm hand? I raise a brow. Wait.
Don't look at me like that.
Still, I fucking wait. She sighs, drops her gaze to the drink, then blurts,
It was nothing. Just silly things like punishing me with a riding whip across my knuckles whenever I forgot to link my letters.
My blood turns to magma. He whipped you? For forgetting to link your letters? I ask, my steady voice betraying none of the violence roiling through my veins.
Asshole, I know. But Pa says only folk with weak hearts complain. So instead, I wrote my tutor hate sonnets I'd send fluttering into the fire, she says, boasting a victorious smirk, like she thinks that rights his wrongs. Now, every time I write something with my perfectly linked script, I want to punch him in the throat. Not that I know how to punch, but I'd like to do it anyway.
I'd like to cut off his head. Her wide eyes snap to mine. She opens her mouth, closes it, shakes her head, dropping her gaze to the drink again. She probably thinks I'm joking. I'm not. I'd like to cut off her pa's head, too, though I don't say that. Was that why you used to run away?
No.
She snatches my drink and gulps deep enough my brows pull together, then lowers the mug, cringing.
Why are you in the Fade anyway?
Hunting for something. Queen owes me a favor. Cadox and Drelgard, I shrug. Timing was opportune.
And if he finds out?
He won't. Not unless you tell on me.
Might consider it. I'm pretty offended by the taste of this drink you let me sip without prior warning.
I lift a brow. The corner of my mouth tugs up the slightest amount. Only because she, too, is smiling. There one instant, gone the next. My own falls. You need help with something. She settles the drink on the table, much softer this time, still nursing the mug while she looks into its half-drained depths and worries her bottom lip. I sigh. Leaning forward, I plant my forearms on the table. What is it, princess? She swallows, and I can hear the violent thump of her heart, rallying in the way hearts do when folk are preparing for battle. Her voice is a rasped whisper when she finally says,
I can hear him.
Who? Another swallow. And she looks up at me with glazed eyes, lifting a pale hand to her diadem. To the ether stone. My blood turns to ice. I push back against the seat, staring, head full of thoughts I can't tame enough to push free of my mouth. A tear shreds down her cheek, and I see her. Truly see her. The dark dents beneath her eyes, her frail, almost skeletal hand, and the way her cheekbones jut out much more than they once did. Her fingernails chewed so close to the knob, she's made them bleed in places. She's wasting away. Something fierce and feral rears up inside me. I lean forward, forcing words past my gritted teeth. How long? She blinks, releasing another tear she's quick to dash away as she drops her stare to the tabletop.
I'm not certain. My nursemaids said I screamed nonstop the first few cycles after I was born. Which they considered strange because the diadem was expected to weaken me. They suspected I could already hear the creators and that I screamed to drown out their prattle. So they clipped an iron necklace on me. Said I immediately calmed.
I swallow thickly. I'd heard she was a restless youngling. But I put it down to the echo of trauma from her start in this world. A world I've grown to hate.
But as I grew older, the silence itched at me in ways I can't describe. And I couldn't shake this feeling that I was missing something. When I was just shy of 18, I took the necklace off. And all I heard was wailing, she rasps.
My throat dries.
His fear, his sadness, it flowed through me like a stream. I felt like I was being ripped apart, piece by piece.
Her gaze flicks up to meet mine, and I think a spear through the heart might hurt less. There's so much pain in those big blue eyes.
I put the necklace back on, she says, wiping her cheeks with her sleeve. Left it on for many, many phases, because I was a coward.
You're not a coward, Kazari. Don't ever speak about yourself like that.
She cuts me a faux smile, then draws another drink of mead, almost draining the mug before she speaks again. I found courage eventually, removed the necklace for the first time in over 80 phases. I listened to his sounds, truly listened. I realized it wasn't just screams and wails, but words, she says, voice cracking as her wide eyes plead with me. I began threading those words together, shaping his language in my mind, learning too much.
My gaze nips at the curtain, and I plant my arms on the table again. There's more, I know there is. She's dancing around the fiery pip like she's afraid to handle it. Keep going. There's a moment of pause before she lifts her chin. And for the first time, since she sat down at my table, I see her as someone with something to guard. Something to lose.
I'm telling you this not because I want your pity. Pity doesn't help me any more than it helped him during those many phases I sat in silence.
Then why?
Because I want help to set him free.
It's like she reached across the table, swung her hand back, and slapped me in the face. Impossible, I growl. It'll kill you. The diadem can only be removed from a pulseless host.
I don't intend to die, Uncle. There has to be another way. I just have to work it out.
I've never wanted to shake someone so much in my life, my hands bunching into fists so tight my knuckles pop. And why do you want to do that? I grind out. The Aether Stone has been passed down for generations. Your ma wore it, her ma before that. On and fucking on!
His name is Kalis, she announces,
her voice stained with a fierce imperial lilt. She pins me with a stare that cuts through flesh and bone.
And because I've fallen in love with him.
A rumble boils deep inside my gut, scalding up my throat with such intense heat I swear my flesh peels off. I know too well how malignant the roots of love can be. I've suffered from the same ailment for over an eon, and I'll continue suffering until the day I die. Kazari's suffering, too. I can see it in her eyes. It's taken her, and it won't let go. If my brother hadn't kept her so sheltered from the world, perhaps she wouldn't have fallen in love with a fucking stone. Perhaps she wouldn't be trying to rid herself of a diadem that could very well take her life the moment it's ripped free. There is no reality where this ends well, I snarl through gritted teeth, and something shatters in her eyes.
You can't know that.
I know he's in that thing for a reason. That your family line was blessed with the power to contain him for a reason. She rips her gaze from mine. Stare, plummeting to the table so fast, she probably thinks I missed the stain of guilt clouding her eyes. What do you know?
Nothing,
she bites out, cheeks flushing. My eyes narrow. What do you know? She shoves to a stand.
This was a mistake. Forget I said anything.
My eyes flare as she flips up her hood and makes for the curtain. Looking at me over her shoulder, she says,
I will leave you with your empty mug.
She goes, her parting words like drips of poison fed to me on a tarnished spoon, leaving the curtain wide open, allowing me a perfect unveiled view of the dais, of the musician perched on the stool beneath an illusion of luminous snowflakes, the vacant seat beside her, haunting me to the marrow. I look at my empty mug, pulling my lungs full, holding the breath. Kazari's right. but my mug's not the only thing that's empty. My chest feels pretty fucking hollow, too.
Rave. Chapter 14. Something bumps against my cheek, ripping me from the fiery clutches of a dream that was melting flesh from my bones in slow, sizzling sweeps. My eyes pop open, a scream sitting in the back of my throat like a wailing beast threatening to split the world in two. I sit up, hissing through clenched teeth, trying to refocus my gaze on the here, the now. Knee flutters around me, frantically nuzzling my chest while I scrub my sweat-dappled skin, trying to scour the terror from my flesh. Unsuccessfully, I rush to my washroom, fill the stone basin with icy water, and splash my face in laden scoops that do little to douse the burn. A dream, I murmur, repeating the motion again. Again. Knee continues to dance around me as I dunk a cloth in the water and use it to dab the back of my neck. I dunk it again, pressing my face into this sodden material. Just a fucking dream. I lift my head, looking in the small mirror hanging on the wall. My eyes are bloodshot, ice blue standing out in stark contrast against the red scribbles, my cheeks flushed from the rabid heat that chased me to the surface. Growling, I screw up the cloth and toss it at the wall, scooping my palms full of water again, splashing my face and dragging the wetness back through my hair. I set my hands on the edge of the basin and close my eyes, humming my calming tune while I focus on my fingertips, then my hands, my arms, moving all the way through my body, slowly loosening each muscle, convincing myself there's nothing here that wants to hurt me. To battle me. Knee nuzzles much too close to my sodden hair, and a warning growl boils up my throat. Don't, Knee. You know how I feel about water getting near you. With a burst of fluttering motion, she rises above my head instead, circling a safe distance away. I'm not certain she has waterproof runes, and I'm in no rush to find out the hard way that she was constructed before they were invented. I press my face into the towel and pour a heavy sigh through the fluffy fabric, untacking the sticky remnants of my terror, a full-body shiver racking through me. That one felt so real. Too real. I jump a few times to shake it off, then move back into my sleep suite, chased by a flutter of parchment wings. My eyes widen at the outside view, the sky clear enough that I can see the aurora already beginning to thread below the western horizon. Falling. Wow. I slept the entire day away. My stomach growls, clamping down on its aching hollow. I'll check on Essie, make us some food if she hasn't already eaten, then try to get back to sleep. Otherwise, I'll be out of sorts for cycles. I make for the stone stairway as a thump sounds from above, like something heavy just fell upon the floor upstairs. Frowning, I pause, scooping Knee against my chest to stall the sound of her beating wings. Shh, I whisper, looking at the ceiling as I listen. Silence prevails. Perhaps I imagined it. Slowly, I tiptoe toward the stairs, pulling the small blade from the sheath at my thigh. I edge close to the trapdoor, pressing my ear to the wood. A soft whimper stills my heart. Essie. I release Knee, nudging her in the direction of my pallet. Stay here, I order, shoving the trapdoor open and bursting through, dropping it back down so Knee doesn't escape. Essie is coiled on the long cedar with her back to me, hiding beneath her woolen blanket that conceals all but her tumble of hair spilling onto the floor. Not unusual, since she sometimes can't be bothered going up the stairs to her sleep suite and nods off on the cedar. My next inhale is laden with a metallic reek, and my heart lurches, stairs slicing around the room, landing on a red, hand-shaped smudge on the windowsill, the size of Essie's hand. Essie's hurt. She always tries to hide when she's hurt. I dash toward her, rip the blanket off, and grab her by the shoulder, tugging her gently onto her back despite her coiled reluctance. My gaze is immediately drawn to her hands clutched atop her abdomen, both of them shaking, slathered in blood. My gut churns as I take in her pallid complexion, the sheen of sweat dappling her brow despite her chattering teeth. I drop to my knees, pulling her hands back and lifting her shirt, revealing a stab wound leaking a constant ribbon of blood. Every cell in my body stills, my lungs seizing, like jagged shards of ice just slit through them. I'm suddenly sure I'm in a different place, a different time, or perhaps I'm caught in one of my slumber terrors. Yes, that must be it. Essie's not lying on the cedar, covered in blood. She doesn't have a hole in her abdomen, right where there are important organs that take time and finesse and a specialized mender to fix. No. She's sitting at the table, working on a diamond cap she's been obsessing over, eating butterman loaf that makes our house smell like a home. This isn't real. Not real. Not, I don't want to end up in the snow, Rafe. Our stares clash, her wide eyes wild with a fear that claws through my chest, threatening to cleave me apart. Snow? What's she talking about?
Please don't drop me down to the cold or put me in the ground, she begs through trembling lips, her eyes so wide the tips of her lashes meet her brows, the red flecks in her irises lit like blown embers. Feed me to the fire, where I'll never be cold again.
Stop talking like you're going anywhere, I growl, stuffing the blanket on her wound to stem the flow. You're staying right here with me, safe in our home. Just as soon as I get her fixed up. You're going to be okay, I murmur, looking to the kitchen cupboard where my mending kit is stored. I need to grab something to pack the wound full and bind it in place so she doesn't bleed out while I carry her down to the ditch. Serene can flesh thread. She'll help if I fall to her feet and beg. She'll probably drip Essie's blood into the vial, using the excuse that she needs the bind to mend her, but I'll find a way to deal with the bitch once Essie's safe. Fuck the repercussions. Put pressure on this. I shift her icy hand and press it upon the blanket. I'm going to grab some supplies so I can get you to Serene.
I'm cold, Rafe.
Her fractured voice cuts a messy hole in the silence, carving into my chest, deflating my lungs. I meet her watery stare that's barely holding focus. Fear erupts behind my ribs with such violent force that cracks weave through my stony heart, exposing the fleshy core, so raw and vulnerable, withering like a juicy fruit tossed to a hungry flame.
I can't feel your...
Her words cut off, breath coming in short, sharp gasps as she works to catch her rhythm again, panic exploding in her eyes.
I can't feel your hand on me. I can't feel it. Rafe!
You're always cold, Essie. I swallow the lump in my throat, battling to keep my voice steady. I know the signs. I've seen death too many times not to know the fucking signs. We live on the cold side. This is normal. It's normal. It's normal. It's... Her face scrunches, and my chest feels like it mimics the motion, making me want to ball up around the ache.
Hold me,
she asks, a wobbly plea that begs me to fall with her into the hungry maw of resignation. Her entire body jerks, hands clawing at her middle, an angry spill of red seeping through the blanket and squelching between her fingers.
Please.
I climb onto the cedar and curl around her, my hand flattened across her chest, the other tangling with the one on her abdomen. She releases a shuddered breath, and I crush our bodies together, holding her so tight I picture my strength binding her like a bandage. Picture her sitting at the table, etching a normal trinket into something exceptional, her mind full of magnificent thoughts and an ample amount of blood in her veins, whole. Happy. But she's not. She's broken in my arms, draining away. Who did this, Essie? She flinches, like my cold, monotone words slit her through.
I didn't see. I rounded a corner and walked straight into him. It was dark.
The Undercity. She went to the Undercity. The realization crushes my windpipe, makes my hands shake, though I try to still them, try to force myself to remain calm and composed. For her. I'm not going to lie here and chastise her for something I specifically asked her not to do, knowing how dangerous it is down there. I'm not going to break her down further when she's already falling apart. I'm going to hug her. Love her. Avenge her.
He was hooded.
Okay, I whisper, brushing her hair back off her face. That helps, Essie. Did you see the color of his hood? Was it red?
No.
Probably not from here. What did he smell like?
Leather, she rasps. Smoke sticks. When he walked away, his boots made clattering sounds.
Clattering sound.
Tell me something that'll make me feel warm, Rafe. Please.
I love you. The admission spills without pause. A heavy truth tilled from the raw, exposed ache in my chest. I realize the words were there all this time, tucked beneath my calloused bits, hiding in a place I thought they were safe. Nothing's ever safe. Why didn't you go to a flesh thread, Essie? Why didn't you?
Because I knew you'd always wonder if I didn't make it out, that you'd think I left you, like they left me.
They. Her family. My heart rips straight down the middle. You're here, I whisper against her ear. I've got you. We've got each other. I bind her deeper into my embrace, holding her tight while she drains away. Blood leaches across the cedar beneath us, a wetness I can't escape seeping through my clothing, sticking to my skin. A wetness that should be pumping through her veins, fueling her life. But it's not. It's not. I nuzzle her hair, filling my lungs with her warm scent, past and present melding together as I recall another embrace, another love, another loss. I hum my calming song while she trembles against me, her heart pumping beneath my hand, each beat slower than the last, quieter, weaker. You're the family I never had, I whisper, and her lungs empty with a shuddered exhale. She doesn't fill them again. I'm not sure how long I hold her, bound around her body that's no longer moving, no longer warm. Long enough that a parchment lark flutters into the room, then bumps against the sill over and over. Perhaps screams, informing me that last slumber's mission is complete, the children free of the city. Long enough that I discern the hard segments of my heart aren't going to shift back together and protect the soft core that feels too much. That I'll have to nurse the hurt until it's calloused over, a realization that makes me not want to rise again. Long enough that I take my time inspecting each moment since I woke, stripping the emotion back like shelling nuts, leaving the smooth pit inside, safe to handle. I bundle all the clutter into piles on the shore of my immense frozen lake that's more silent than it's ever been, then ferry them across the surface. Silver light spears up from beneath while I carve an icy grave to drop the parcels down. A curious luminosity that hunts every step, chasing me back and forth between the shore and the hole. Something that would usually frighten me. But I'm numb. Hollow. I've lost Essie, and I've lost the will to care about anything but the thing that keeps me upright. Keeps me moving forward. Vengeance. Dropping the final package beneath the frosty expanse, I rise back into myself, raising my hand to brush Essie's hair back from her too pale face. You sleep. Eyes squeezed shut, I kiss her temple, letting the moment linger. I'm going to find whoever did this to you, I pledge against her cold skin. I'm going to find them, Essie. And I'm going to make them hurt. I tuck my arm from beneath her stiff body, my bottom lip trembling as I untangle our legs and step off the cedar. I swathe the blanket around her shoulders to keep her nice and warm, then make for the stairs on unsteady legs, bracing myself against the wall so I can heft the trapdoor up. Knee swarms free in a wobbly waggle, bumping against my cheek, neck, and chest while I go about the motions of moving down the stairs, eyes cast blankly ahead. Not bothering to remove my blood-stained skin suit, I strap a sheath to my other thigh, tucking the many pockets full of small dragon-scale daggers, while Knee continues to bump against me in a frenzied flutter. She nosedives toward the ground, but I pinch her from the air, gently setting her on a shelf. Not that she stays there long. Motions becoming sharp and precise, I thread my arms through my leather bandolier laden with iron blades, stuffing my feet in black boots and lacing them to the knee. I bind a veil around my neck, then move up the stairs, chased by the sound of parchment wings. I pause by the table while Knee bumps, bumps, bumps. She nuzzles into my neck like she thinks she's safe. She's not. Nobody I care about ever is. I swallow the thickening lump in my throat and snatch a quill, dip it in a pot of ink, then swoop Knee into my hand and unpleat her face, tail, wings, and body, flattening her upon the table where I read her message one final time. I need you. No, you don't, I rasp, scratching the words upon the parchment in my less than perfect handwriting, butchering beautiful Knee into something far less tender, less vulnerable. I need you. No, you don't.